This biography is unlike any book you have read before. Of course, there is drama. Around him, the house groaned as it twisted to death. Plaster fell from the ceiling like rain and burst from the walls like popcorn. A loud crack echoed down the hall. The floor jerked as the house shifted, sending Bill crashing into the closet door. Another crack sounded close behind the first, along with the noise of splintering wood. The flood was ripping the building from its foundation. Running down the hallway, Bill plunged through the front door, not knowing that the porch had just been separated from the house. He landed in icy water. But natural drama is just the beginning. Then comes the supernatural, and nothing is ever the same. Supernatural, The Life of William Branham. Volume 1, Books 1, 2, and 3, covering the years from 1909 to 1950. Written by Owen Jorgensen. Narrated by Kathy Strew. Somewhere in this world, there is a sincere teenager who is searching for answers to questions like these. Does God really exist? If so, who is he? And where is he? And is this God interested in my life? To you, young searcher, this book is dedicated, for so once was I. Owen Jorgensen. Introduction. In 1971, while I was a student at Seattle Pacific College, I read Gordon Lindsay's short book called William Branham, A Man Sent from God. I was so astounded by William Branham's life and ministry that I started reading everything I could find about him. I was 19 years old, and at that time my goal was to become a writer. I recognized that here was one of the greatest stories of our time, and I wondered if I could write a detailed biography about this extraordinary man. Realistically, at that young age, I did not have the skills necessary to organize a massive project, let alone write it, so it isn't surprising that my dream gradually faded. The years passed, I got married, had 4 children, and tried my hand at different jobs until in 1978 I returned to work on my family's wheat farm. In 1987, when I was 35 years old, I took some winter quarter classes at the Wenatchee Valley College, eager to learn some new skills that would help me in the business of agriculture. I took a course in accounting, a course on computers, and just for fun, a course in composition writing. I turned in my first writing assignment for the teacher to evaluate. When she handed it back, I saw she had written across the top of the page, "Can I use this as an example for the rest of the class?" On every assignment I turned in, this teacher wrote the same words on the top of my first page. After 4 weeks of this, I thought, I wonder if God is trying to tell me something. A few days later, while standing in the college library, I prayed, "Lord, what do you want me to do with my life?" Instantly, I was hammered by a thought so clear and powerful that I knew it was God speaking to me. He said, "I want you to write a biography of William Branham." I was stunned. It had been 12 years since I had last thought about writing such a book. Without a moment of deliberation, I said, "I'm going to write William Branham's life story, even if it takes me 10 years to do it." It ended up taking me 23 years to finish. There is a lot of information available on William Branham's ministry, but be warned, Internet sites that criticize him are woefully misinformed. Of course, when I started this project in 1985, there wasn't an Internet. My original sources included newspaper articles, magazine articles, books, and several short films from the 1950s and 60s, as well as many people who were eyewitnesses to the events I have written about, especially the events in the last 3 books of this series. But mostly, at first, I gathered information from William Branham's recorded sermons. Over 1,000 of his sermons were recorded on magnetic tape from 1947 to 1965. I listened to these sermons one by one, in the order that he preached them. This process was in itself gratifying and inspiring. I felt like I was following this great evangelist all over the world, which, in one sense, I was. When he told stories about his life, I typed them into my word processor. This was before his sermons became available on a computer database program. I'll say more about this computer database program in my end notes. Often he told stories about things that had just happened to him recently. With the event fresh in his mind, he not only told what happened and what was said, he often told what he was thinking and feeling, making it easier for me as a biographer to get it right. After 2 years of research, I had collected over 1,000 pages of single-spaced typewritten notes. That's when I said to myself, "Owen, are you going to write this book or not? You certainly have enough information to start writing, so either write or else stop telling yourself you are writing a book." First, I had to organize my notes. I bought 56 file folders and marked them with each year of William Branham's life. Reading through my notes, I figured out when each story happened, and then cut it out with scissors, placing it in the file folder for that year. Then I opened the file folder marked 1909 and read everything in it so the details would be fresh in my mind. Finally, I turned on my word processor, took a deep breath, and began. Originally, I wrote the first chapter two different ways. My first draft began, "William Branham was born in Kentucky in the year 1909. It read like a high school English report. All the facts were there, but it lacked something. I thought, there is so much drama here, why can't I use that drama to draw readers into the story? I wrote the first chapter again using this concept, and I liked the results, so I continued with this method throughout the series. Months later, my 13-year-old daughter Hannah was lying on her stomach on our living room floor reading the loose pages of this manuscript. I think she was on chapter 5 when Hannah looked up at me wide-eyed and said, 'Dad, this is really good.' Then she went back to reading. That let me know that I was on the right track. Since then, I've received many letters from people all over the world who have been blessed by this account of William Branham's life. Today, as I write this introduction, there are several hundred thousand copies printed in English of Supernatural, The Life of William Branham, books 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. They have also been translated into a number of other languages. See supernaturalchristianbooks.com. That is supernaturalchristianbooks.com. The reason we, that is Reverend Perry Green of Tucson Tabernacle in Tucson, Arizona, and I originally printed this series in single volumes was simply because I was still writing the series. We printed each book as it was completed. Now that the final chapter in this biography of William Branham is finished, I am reprinting the first 5 books along with the 6th book in a 3-volume set. I hope this biography reminds you how close Jesus Christ is to you right now, and even more importantly, how much he cares. Owen Jorgensen, January 2010. Now thanks be to God who always leads us in triumph in Christ and through us diffuses the fragrance of his knowledge in every place. 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 14, New King James Version.
Holy be thee, all things are possible.
Supernatural, The Life of William Branham. This is the most phenomenal true story you will ever read. It will change the way you think about the world you live in and the world beyond. Chapter 1, Mysterious Birth Sign, covering the years 1909 to 1912. 15 is not too young to have a baby, muttered Ella Branham to herself, trying to bolster her courage. Why, I'm just as ready as... The pain struck again, stronger, more commanding than before. Ella felt her panic rise with a spreading discomfort. She held her swollen stomach and groaned. Not yet. Please, not yet. Not until Charles comes home. Beads of sweat popped out in her forehead. She staggered across the dirt floor to the cabin's only window, set in the middle of a crude wooden door. The window had no glass, only a wooden shutter which Ella left open during the day and closed at night. Now it was open. "Charles!" she screamed. Her voice seemed to evaporate into the Kentucky backwoods, with its vast expanse of hills and hollows stretching out from her in every direction. Knowing her nearest neighbor lived miles away made Ella feel desperately alone. The pain tightened around her stomach, driving her into a panic. "Charles!" she screamed. Again, "Charles! Where are you?" Then her voice sank into a feeble sob. "Please come home. I need you." Charles Branham had received his logging pay that morning and had walked into Burkesville, Kentucky to buy a new pair of bib overalls. "In honor of my first child," he said. But what was keeping him so long? Had he gotten waylaid by a tavern? If so, it would not have been the first time in their one-year marriage. But surely Charles wouldn't do such a thing today. He knew their baby was due any time. The contraction subsided, leaving her spent. Ella sagged against the splintery door jamb, watching the sun settle behind the maples and oaks that had just begun to bud. It was April in the year 1909. Ella shivered as she closed the shutter. Now the only light in the cabin came from the sunset filtering through the chinks between the roughly squared logs. Pencil beams of light moved slowly across the table, a homemade affair, built from a sawed-off tree stump with wooden pegs for legs and a bench for a seat. The only other piece of furniture in the single 12-foot-long room was a primitive bed nailed to one wall. Ella staggered to the bed and collapsed on its straw tick, pulling the quilt up to her chin. The corn-shuck pillow crackled under her head with every move. As the room darkened to black, Ella thought about her former home in Paris, Texas, which she had so recently wanted to escape. Last year it had seemed intolerable, but now, from this position, it did not seem so bad. She had grown up in Texas as Ella Harvey. Her father was a hunter, trapper, and schoolteacher. Her mother was a full-blooded Cherokee Indian. Ella, the oldest of four children, had lived a wonderful, carefree childhood until 3 years ago when her mother died from scarlet fever. At that time, Ella was barely 12 years old, and her youngest brother was only 4. The chore of mothering fell heavily into Ella's lap. A little over a year ago, she'd met Charles Branham at a rodeo. Charles was short and handsome, with curly black hair, broad shoulders, and enough cowboy skills to defeat almost every bucking bronco that he challenged. Ella was smitten by his charm. Charles was 18 and she was 14, but she felt years older. At that time, marriage had seemed like a good way to avoid the drudgery of caring for her younger siblings. Now she wondered if she had merely jumped from one hot frying pan into another. Here she was, 15 years old, a stranger in the Kentucky hills, having a baby 40 miles from the nearest doctor, with not even a friend to call on for help. Burying her head in her pillow, Ella wept. Charles Branham returned to the cabin an hour after dark. He had been drinking, of course, but not enough to dull his thinking. He inched the door open quietly so that he wouldn't disturb his young wife if she were asleep. Then he heard her moan. Charles quickly lit a pine knot and set it on the lid of a fruit jar. The pine knot burned with a dim, sputtering light that gave off volumes of smoke. Because the cabin was naturally ventilated, the smoke drifted up past the rafters, sifting out through the cracks in the clapboard shingles overhead. "Charles," Ella whispered weakly, "tonight's the night. Go fetch your mama." Charles built a fire, then he hurried to his mother's cabin. The night was cold and clear, and the starlight made it easy to keep on the path. An hour later, he returned with his mother and two neighbor women. Grandma Branham was a crusty old woman, tough as bacon rind, but seeing this little 15-year-old girl in labor softened her like hot coon grease softens boot leather. Not that Grandma Branham ever used boots herself. She'd never owned a pair of shoes in her life. Now she took charge of the situation. Having had 17 children of her own, she was well prepared to act as midwife for her new daughter-in-law. She insisted that Charles wait outside. He did not argue. Taking a blanket, he crawled under the lean-to tacked onto one end of the cabin, making his bed on the wood chips and bark. Pulling a flask of whiskey out of his pocket, Charles polished it off to calm his nerves. Before long, he fell sound asleep. As dawn approached, the commotion inside the cabin grew more intense. Charles roused. The eastern horizon was turning lighter with the approach of dawn, but the sun had not yet risen. He cursed himself for having dozed, and then started to worry because his baby had not yet been born. Was something wrong? Maybe he should go inside and check. Before he could make up his mind, he heard the high-pitched squall of a newborn. The cabin door flew open, and one of the neighbor women called, "Charles Branham, it's a boy." Sheepishly, Charles shuffled inside and closed the door. The room smelled of smoke from a grease candle on the table. Grandma Branham finished washing the infant, weighed him at 5 pounds, then gently laid him in his mother's arms. Charles stood near the bed with his hands tucked into the bib of his new overalls, nervously watching this wiggling, grunting little creature that was his son. Ella said, "Charles, he's got your blue eyes." Charles studied the small eyes, but in the dim light he couldn't tell their color. "We'll call his first name William," he said, "and his middle name will be Marion." Ella tested the name with her tongue. William Marion Branham. It sounded distinguished enough, and he can go by the name of Billy. "Charles, I think Billy's going to have your curly hair, too. Open the shutter so I can see him better." It was shortly after 5 o'clock, Tuesday morning, April 6, 1909. Daylight filtered in through the chinks, even though the sun had not yet topped the horizon. Charles opened the shutter, then drew back, startled. Something had darted through the open window. A light, like a star, about a foot in diameter. Ella screamed and cradled her son tightly to her bosom. The others, bewildered, stepped back against the wall. The strange light circled the room several times, then stopped over the bed, hovering above the new mother and the child, glowing yellowish-green, pulsating with a life of its own. For less than a minute it held that position. Not long, yet long enough for everyone in the cabin to be sure they had really seen it. Then as quickly as it had come in, the fireball left, whirling up past the rafters and out through the roof. Charles stared up at the clapboard shingles with wide, unblinking eyes. Suddenly, a flurry of wings turned his attention towards the door where a dove had landed on the sill of the open window. The snow-white dove eyed the room with curiosity, almost as if looking for something. When it spotted the newborn baby, it cocked its head and cooed before it flew away. Charles gazed after the bird for a moment, then rolled his eyes back up towards the roof. One of the neighbor women muttered, "Well, I never." The other mused, "I wonder what kind of young'un this boy will be." Billy Branham was only 15 minutes old. News spread quickly among the mountain folk about that young'un born yonder on the hill with a light over him. Some passed it off as sunlight reflecting from a mirror. Ella and Charles knew better, since there were no mirrors in their cabin. Besides, the sun had not yet come up. They were puzzled. Was there some spiritual meaning in the light? Charles wanted to forget it, but Ella wouldn't let him. She insisted that something must be done, and finally decided that their baby should be taken to a church and dedicated to God. At first, Charles argued against this idea, but finally he consented, although the concession raked against the grain of his character. Now the question came up, where should they take him? The ancestry of Charles Branham was strictly Irish Catholic. On Ella's side, the Harveys were Irish Catholic too, except for Ella's mother, who belonged to the Cherokee Nation. However, both Charles and Ella had drifted completely away from their Catholic foundation, and neither of them had any formal religious convictions. They agreed that for their purpose, the best church was the nearest church. So when Billy Branham was 2 weeks old, Charles and Ella bundled him up and took him down to the Opossum Kingdom Baptist Church, where a small congregation met each Sunday in a rustic log building with a dirt floor and pews made from boards lying across upturned blocks of wood. The Opossum Kingdom Baptist Church had no regular pastor. On most Sundays, the congregation sang songs and read from the Bible. But every 2 months, a circuit preacher came through and delivered a sermon. The old preacher was there today. He offered prayer over little William Marion Branham, asking God to someday use this boy in his service. It was the last time Billy Branham would enter a church building for 23 years. Logging often forced Charles to be away from his wife and son during the week. That October in 1909, a blizzard stranded him in a lumber camp far from home. Ella, 4 months pregnant with their second child, worried as her supplies dwindled. When her firewood ran out, she wrapped her feet in burlap bags and struggled through the waist-high drifts and biting wind, fighting her way into the woods to chop down saplings and dead branches, dragging them back into the cabin in a desperate attempt to keep her fire going. But when her food gave out, she despaired. The fire cooled to ashes. Ella was too weak to make another trip outside for wood. Gathering every scrap of clothing in the cabin, she wrapped herself and her son as best she could, crawled into bed, and pulled the quilt over them. Outside, the wind howled unceasingly. The room chilled until her water bucket froze. Ella stared up into the rafters and considered again that strange light at her son's birth. She had thought of it often over the past 6 months. Sometimes she believed it was a sign that Billy was destined for greatness. Now it seemed meaningless, since death for both of them could not be far away. Her nearest neighbor was an old man who lived across the valley. When the storm blew out, this neighbor stepped outside to do some chores. He could just see the top of the Branham cabin, and he noticed there was no smoke rising from the chimney. At the time, he didn't give it much thought, but after several days, he grew concerned. He knew smoke had been coming from the cabin before the storm, and no one could have left the cabin during the storm. Figuring something might be wrong, he decided to investigate. As he approached the cabin, he saw there were no tracks in the new-fallen snow. That confirmed his fear that no one had left the cabin after the storm ended. He knocked, but got no reply. When he tried the door, he found it was locked from the inside. Now he knew someone was in there, someone who must be in serious trouble, or they would have answered him. With a great effort, he managed to force open the door. What he found inside made him shudder. Ella and her baby were huddled on the bed, almost dead from cold and starvation. Hurriedly, the neighbor grabbed Ella's axe and went into the woods, bringing back enough fuel to warm the cabin. Finding no food, he trudged home and returned with as many groceries as he could carry. Calling a doctor was out of the question, so the old man took care of the young mother and child himself. By the time Charles broke through the drifts to his cabin, his wife and son were starting to recover their strength. The rest of that winter, Charles stayed close to home, hunting and trapping to keep the larder filled. In the spring, he went back to logging. After the ice thawed, he would hitch up an ox to the logs and one by one drag them down to the Cumberland River, where other loggers would lash them together into a raft, float them down to the Ohio River, and then on to the Mississippi. In March of 1910, Charles and Ella had their second child, Edward. A few months later, Ella, now 16, felt another baby growing in her womb. She bore her third child early in 1911. It was another boy. She named him Henry. Charles logged through the spring and summer into the fall of 1911. Then misfortune struck again, ripping Charles from his young family and almost destroying him. As the youngest of 17 children, Charles Branham had grown up with many rough teachers. He learned to hold his whiskey when he was just a boy, and he learned to settle disputes with his fists. In the fall of 1911, Charles was at a party when a fight broke out. Moonshine and hardened men made a wicked mix, and soon the fight grew into a ferocious brawl involving everyone in the room. One powerful bully named Willie Yarborough knocked a friend of Charles to the floor, jumped on him and drew his knife, and was about to plunge it into his heart when Charles brought a chair down on Willie's head. Charles backed away and drew his own blade. Willie forgot the man on the floor and went after Charles. Willie would have slit Charles' throat if he had gotten the chance. He was a merciless man who had killed his own son with a fence rail, but Charles' knife found its mark first, leaving Willie in a pool of blood, senseless, though still alive. News of this brawl reached Burkesville, Kentucky. Charles was implicated as a ringleader and charged with attempted murder. A sheriff rode up on horseback to arrest him. Before the sheriff could find him, Charles caught wind of his danger. He had to leave in a hurry, not knowing where he would go or what he would do. Before he left, he promised Ella that as soon as he found work and a place for them to live, he would send for her, using an assumed name so he could not be traced. And so, in the space of an afternoon, Charles Branham vanished, leaving his wife alone in the woods to fend for herself and their three babies. Billy was 2 1/2, Edward was 1 1/2, and Henry was barely 6 months old. At 17, Ella was almost a child herself. Before a few weeks had passed, she realized Charles had left a part of himself with her. She was pregnant again. That fall and winter stretched Ella to the limit of her strength. She seemed to be living through a nightmare, trying to care for three babies in a rude, isolated cabin, while she herself felt nauseated much of the time. She had no money, no resources, and no energy. If it had not been for the help of Charles' relatives, poor as they were, Ella knew she would not have survived. But finally the seasons changed, the ground thawed, and her nausea ended. Henry passed his first birthday, Edward his second, and Billy his third. The baby kicking and twisting in Ella's womb was getting near delivery. Once during that spring of 1912, a sheriff stopped by the cabin to ask if Ella had heard from her husband. She could tell the truth. She had not heard from him and had no idea where he was. A few days after the sheriff's visit, Billy and Edward were playing outside the cabin where a small spring kept the ground muddy. Billy wanted to show his younger brother how strong he was, so he picked up the biggest rock he could lift, held it over his head, and threw it towards the spring. The rock sank deep into the muck by the water's edge, splattering mud all over Edward, who promptly cried and waddled back to the cabin. A robin began to chirp with gusto. Billy searched the branches until he spied the bird in a nearby tree. He took one step toward it, and the robin flew away. At that moment, something so startling happened that it would brand itself to his tender mind and become his first significant childhood memory. From where the robin had been perched, there came a sound like wind rustling the leaves. Whoosh! Then a voice boomed from the tree. A very clear human voice which said, "You will live near a city called New Albany." With a shriek of terror, Billy took off for the cabin as fast as his stubby legs could take him, squealing, "Mama! Mama!" Ella was wiping mud from Edward's tummy. "Billy, what happened?" she asked as she hugged her oldest son to her side. "A bird talked to me, Mama. I heard him singing in the tree. Then he talked to me." Ella laughed. "You were dreaming, child." "But Billy insisted. I heard him, Mama. I heard him talk." "And what did the bird say?" Ella teased, still thinking it was Billy's imagination. "He said we would live near a city called New Albany." This reply startled her. It did not seem like something a small boy would make up in his play. She stepped around behind the cabin and called into the woods. "Hello? Anybody there?" When she came back inside, Billy asked, "Mama, where is New Albany?" "It's a town in Indiana, just across the river from Louisville, Kentucky, about 100 miles from here." "Billy, where did you hear talk of New Albany?" "I ain't never heard of New Albany, Mama, until that bird talked to me." "Mama, when are we going to live there? Will Papa live there with us?" Ella shook her head. Several weeks later, a long-awaited letter from Charles arrived. Ella sat at the stump table, staring at the envelope she held between her trembling fingers. Billy stood on his tiptoes, peeking over the tabletop. "Open it, Mama." Ella giggled nervously. "Of course. We've waited a long time for this. Why wait any longer?" Carefully, she undid the glued flap, removed the letter from its envelope, opened it, and began to read. Since her father was a schoolteacher, she had received a fair education, but Charles had almost no schooling and could neither read nor write, not even his own name. One of his brothers living in Louisville had written this letter for him. "What does it say, Mama?" Billy asked. She talked as she read. "It says that your papa is in Indiana. He's found steady work and a place for us to live, and he wants us to come right away. It's in a little town called Utica, about 10 miles northeast of..." She stopped abruptly and looked with amazement at her 3-year-old son. How could it be? "Where, Mama? Where is Utica?" Billy persisted. Ella said slowly, "Billy, we're going to live 10 miles northeast of New Albany, Indiana." Chapter 2, His First Vision, covering the years 1912 to 1916. Charles Branham had enclosed enough money with his letter so that Ella could hire a wagon for the move. She had few possessions to load, other than her 3 squirming boys. New Albany lay over 100 miles north of Burkesville, and being almost due to deliver, Ella dreaded the journey. But to 3-year-old Billy, who had never seen beyond his mountain cabin, the trip seemed like an exciting adventure. He was especially impressed by the narrow, flat wooden bridge that crossed the Ohio River between Louisville, Kentucky, and New Albany, Indiana. Another 10 miles north brought them to their new home, the small town of Utica, Indiana. On May 27, 1912, Ella bore her 4th son, naming him Melvin. That summer, Charles worked for a local farmer. It was man-killing labor. Sometimes he had to trudge behind a horse and plow for 12 hours a day, sweating under the scorching sun. More than once he came home with his shirt sunburned into his back, and Ella had to cut the shirt off with scissors. When the corn came up, Charles spent his days with a goose-necked hoe, chopping creepers from between the rows. At first his hands blistered and bled. Later they formed calluses as hard as leather. He suffered all this for a mere 75 cents a day. That fall, Charles went back to logging. It came to him more naturally than farming. He had grown up in the woods and had started logging at an early age. Although he weighed only 150 pounds, Charles bulged with muscles and was so skillful a logger that he could load a 900-pound log on a wagon all by himself. But as winter drew near, Charles grew uneasy. The 6 of them were living in a 1-room shack, no bigger and not as well built as the log cabin they left behind in Kentucky. Logging would force him to be away from his family for weeks at a time. Not wanting his wife to suffer like she had the last winter, Charles started looking for a better situation. Spring came in 1913 before Charles found something permanent. He got a job in Jeffersonville, Indiana, working for Mr. Wathan, a multimillionaire who owned the Wathan Distilleries and was part owner of a professional baseball team, the Louisville Colonels. Charles was hired as a private chauffeur because he was so good at handling horses. The job didn't pay much in cash, but it offered substantial side benefits, namely a place to live rent-free on Mr. Wathan's land. The site included a 2-room log cabin, an old barn, a large garden spot, and a small field Charles could plant for his own profit. Also, Mr. Wathan had a dairy nearby, and Charles could take home a bucket of milk every night, no small benefit for a father with 4 growing boys. Jeffersonville was a town 4 miles northeast of New Albany, on the river road locally called the Utica Pike. Mr. Wathan lived 7 miles out of town on a large estate. The cabin Charles moved into sat on a hillside overlooking the Ohio River. Weathered boards covered the structure's outside walls, and inside mud filled the chinks between the logs. The cabin had a dirt floor, 2 rooms, and a sleeping loft in the rafters above one of the rooms. The ladder to the loft was made from 2 saplings. In the middle of the floor of one room, a sawed-off stump had been rolled and flat rocks placed on top of the stump. Above this sat a wood stove made from an empty oil drum. For cooking, Ella used a little monkey stove. They even had a coal oil lamp for light. All things considered, it was a big improvement over the 1-room shanty that had sheltered them in Utica. On the hillside in front of the cabin, an apple tree spread its branches over a small spring. The cool spring water served as a refrigerator through much of the summer, keeping metal cans of milk, buttermilk, and butter from spoiling too soon. Charles couldn't keep cream there. He had too many little Branhams greedy to snitch. The spring supplied the house with water until mid-August, when it would finally grow dry. Then they would have to pump their water from the well located down by the barn
and carry it up the hill to the house. Billy loved the bubbling spring. A gourd dipper hung on a nail pounded into the trunk of the apple tree, but Billy seldom used it. He liked to lie on his belly in the warm grass, put his lips to the water, and suck his stomach full. Then he would fill a jug and take it to his father in the field. Charles always came home from the field famished for supper. Because he didn't have indoor plumbing, he would wash himself behind the cabin, where a bench was built against an apple tree. The bench was just a barn board tacked to the trunk, with a board at the other side for a leg and a slanting board underneath to keep the bench sturdy. All four boys would stand in line behind Papa to wash. When Charles rolled up the sleeves of his homemade shirt to lather up, his arm muscles would swell and ripple. Billy watched with pride, thinking, "That's my Papa. He's strong. He'll live 100 years. When I'm an old man, I'll still be watching my Papa with big muscles." Charles was only 5 feet 7 inches tall. Billy had inherited his father's dark, wavy hair and Irish good looks, but not his powerful build. Instead, Billy was lean and wiry like his mother. Billy's turn to wash came next. He took great care to keep the homemade lye soap out of his eyes. Once had been lesson enough. He dried with a towel his mother had made from an empty sack of cornmeal. The towel was coarse and uncomfortable, so Billy dabbed lightly. Above the washbench, a piece from a broken mirror was held to the tree by 5 bent nails. Billy shinnied up on the bench to see himself so that he could use the tin comb to smooth his unruly locks. Charles had built their dinner table and benches from old barn boards. The benches looked like church pews. Billy always sat next to his father at supper. Bean soup was standard fare, along with cornbread, boiled onions, and buttermilk. Ella would bake the cornbread in a pan, then put it on a plate and send the plate around the table so that everyone could break off a piece as it passed. Billy always took a corner because it had lots of crust, and he liked dipping crusty cornbread in his soup. On May 14, 1914, Billy got another brother, Edgar Lee Branham. Over the next few years, Billy's life fell into a comfortable pattern. Every Saturday afternoon, his father borrowed a mule and a covered wagon from Mr. Wathan, loaded up the family, and traveled 7 miles into town to buy groceries. The 4 youngest Branhams bounced along and back in a pile of straw, but Billy got to ride up front on the buckboard with his father and mother. Billy was always excited about going to the store because he knew exactly what would happen. Charles, who earned $3.50 a week, often spent $3 of this at the grocery store. Occasionally, he splurged on a sack of brown sugar or salted barrel crackers, but mostly he bought staples like beans, potatoes, and cornmeal, the kind of food that stretched a long way. After Charles paid his bill, Mr. Grover, the grocer, would give him a sack of peppermint stick candy for his youngsters. Back in the wagon, 5 pairs of eyes watched anxiously as Papa divided 4 sticks of candy equally between his 5 boys. Right away, the 4 youngest Branhams sucked their peppermint sticks to a sliver, but Billy was shrewd. He sucked on his for a while, then rolled his candy up in a piece of brown paper torn from a grocery bag and tucked it in his pocket. He had use for it later. Saturday night, they filled the large cedar washtub with hot water and took their weekly baths, one after another, without changing the water. Ella scrubbed Billy hard with lye soap, saying, "I want to see you get as clean as a peeled onion." Then she rubbed him dry with a meal cloth towel until it felt like his hide was gone. She knew Billy was not eating a balanced diet, so every week after his bath she made him swallow a spoonful of castor oil, which she believed would help prevent colds. Billy looked at that big spoon filled with the greasy castor oil and begged, "Oh, Mama, please don't make me take it. It makes me so sick. I can't stand it." She answered, "If it don't make you sick, it won't do you any good." Billy held his nose, took the spoonful in his mouth, tried to swallow, gagged, shook all over, and finally managed to get it down. On Sunday, Ella cooked mulligan stew, turnips, carrots, cabbage, potatoes, beans, cornmeal, and a chunk of beef, everything boiled together in one pot. The leftovers fed them for 2 or 3 days. Monday, Ella washed clothes outside the cabin in a big iron kettle heated over an open fire. Billy, being the eldest, had to cut locust limbs for the fire. He was also expected to fill the kettle with water. a difficult chore for a boy his age and size. "William," she called. "Yes, ma'am." "Go to the spring and get a bucket of water." Billy thought of how that heavy cedar bucket strained his shoulder, even when it was only half full. He felt in his pocket for that piece of peppermint candy wrapped in paper. Then he found his brother Edward and said, "Humpy?" Billy often called his brother Humpy. "I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll let you lick on this candy until I count 10, if you'll go and get that bucket of water for me." Edward gladly fetched the water, and Billy rewarded him by holding out the peppermint stick. Billy started counting. 1, 2, 3. Edward, licking as fast as he could go, complained, "Not so fast. You're counting too fast. Start over." Billy started over, and Edward got a few extra licks. Then Billy wrapped up the peppermint stick and put it back in his pocket. There were other chores to do on Monday, but as long as his candy held out, Billy was a young man of leisure. On wash day, Ella used a long, flat hickory stick to stir clothes in the boiling kettle, fishing them out when they were ready. She kept the stick hanging on a nail just inside the cabin door. That hickory paddle served many functions. Ella mashed lumps out of the straw-tick mattresses with it, then smoothed out the bedding quilts. Charles also used it as a rod of correction. Sometimes, if one of the boys had been bad and was expecting a spanking, the hickory stick would mysteriously disappear. Charles always managed to get by without it, using instead his razor strap made out of an old belt, or else the ramrod from his rifle. All the little Branhams got an education out in the woodshed, running around their father as hard as they could go while he whipped their bottoms red. Charles called this beating the devil out of them. On one occasion, Edward hatched a mischievous plan. "Billy," he said, "Mama and Papa are hoeing in the garden. If you go in and get some sugar, I'll get the crackers and I'll meet you in the barn." It sounded fair enough to Billy. Ella kept the brown sugar in a box in the cabin. She often mixed it with water to make molasses for their breakfast pancakes. Billy slipped into the cabin, dug out a big handful of sugar, and started for the barn. The garden was halfway down the hill between the house and the barn. Charles straightened up from his hoe, wiping his forehead with his red and white checkered handkerchief. He noticed his oldest son walking with his far arm as stiff as if he were hiding something. Charles said, "Where are you going, William?"
"I'm going down to the barn."
"What have you got in your hand?" Billy thought, "Uh-oh." He tried to be evasive. "Which hand?" Charles said, "Come here." Billy didn't want any more sugar for a long time after that. Late in August of 1916, after a steam-powered threshing machine had finished processing the grain crops, Ella stuffed new straw into all her tick mattresses. That night, shortly after the boys were sent to bed in the loft, Billy screamed as if a banshee had touched his cheek. Ella dashed to the ladder and called, "Billy, what on earth's wrong with you?"
"Mama, there's something in bed with me."
"It's just a grasshopper trapped in the new straw. Now settle down and go to sleep."
"Mama, I can't go to sleep with that critter jumping around in there."
Ella took the coal oil lamp in hand and climbed up to the loft so Billy could see to open the side of his tick, dig around in the fresh straw, and find the offending grasshopper. He let it go outside by pushing it through a crack where the roof did not butt evenly with the wall. Later, Ella chuckled about the incident when she told it to Charles, but she could not tell her husband about her deep concern for Billy. The boy had been edgy lately, and his food wasn't setting right. More than once in the past month, he had complained of an upset stomach after supper and of burping up stomach acid. Was he nervous because he would soon start school? Or was something else bothering him? Could it be connected with his father's drinking? In September, Billy and Edward started school together. Billy was 7.5 years old. Although he was 11 months older than his brother Edward, in size they could have passed for twins. Edward was just a smidgen shorter. Billy had no clothes for school. Through the summer, he had gone barefoot and without a shirt, wearing a pair of patched and tattered bib overalls. The family could not afford new clothes, so Ella improvised. She took the coat Charles had worn in their wedding day, cut it up, and sewed together a pair of pants. Charles came home with white socks and a used pair of tennis shoes that barely fit, and that completed Billy's wardrobe. When Ella finished dressing him for his newest adventure, she said,
There, now let's have a look at you. She stood back for perspective. His bare ribs made him look so small and skinny. He looked so backward with his shaggy hair hanging down his neck, his homemade trousers, and his second-hand tennis shoes. Ella smiled and said, "If you don't look like a windy Kentuckian." She had done the best she could with what she had. Unfortunately, her oldest son would have to go to school without his shirt. So, on a chilly morning in September of 1916, Billy and Edward trudged down the river road to Utica Pike's school, which was a typical, rural, one-room schoolhouse set among the hills in view of the Ohio River. Mrs. Temple would be his teacher for many years. She taught all 8 grades, with students ranging in age from 6 to 15. In school, Billy learned more than the 3 R's of reading, writing, and arithmetic. Suddenly, his view of the world expanded. As he sat in class, he had time to compare himself with the other children. The differences shouted at him. These were country boys and girls like himself, but most of them wore nice clothes and shoes that fit, and they all wore shirts. For lunch, the other children ate sandwiches and had cookies or cake for dessert. Billy ate beans, and some days he had no lunch at all. He began to realize his family was poor. From the first, Billy was branded as an outsider by the older boys. They called him a corn cracker and teased him because he talked funny, with a hillbilly accent typical of the Kentucky mountain folks, and they laughed at him for looking so ragged. A few weeks after school started, Billy and some other boys his own age decided to spend an afternoon fishing at the ice pond behind the Branhams' cabin. They called it the ice pond because Mr. Wathan cut blocks of ice from it every winter, stored the blocks in sawdust, then used them during the summer to keep ice boxes cold in his dairy. Billy was thrilled that these boys included him in their plans. Not only did he love to fish, but he longed to be part of the gang. After school, Billy ran home, eager to get his homemade fishing pole down from the loft. His tennis shoes did not fit well and had caused a painful corn to form on his big toe. That day in school, he had been preoccupied with the corn. Each time he moved his foot, the corn tortured him so much he could not keep his mind on his schoolwork. Now, in his excitement and haste, he easily ignored the pain. He dashed into the cabin and had just placed a foot on the sapling ladder when a powerful hand gripped his shoulder. His father turned him around. "Billy, I've got an important job for you to do this afternoon. I want you to pack water up to the stills for me." Billy's heart and limbs petrified. "But, Papa, I was going to go fishing with my buddies this afternoon." "You can go fishing tomorrow. I'm fixing to run off a batch of corn whiskey tonight, and I'm behind. I've got to have enough water in the shed to keep those coils cool. You're old enough to work, and I've got to have your help. The buckets are down by the barn, sitting next to the pump. Now get on up and change your clothes. I'll be out back in the shed getting the stills ready." Slowly, Billy started up the ladder, turning his head so his father would not see his tears. "And remember," Charles added, "keep mum. Not a word about this to anyone." "Yes, Papa." Although national prohibition would not be voted in until 1919, certain states had anti-liquor laws in place as early as 1906. In 1916, Indiana was already a dry state. Charles could not do without his whiskey. Since he did not have enough money to buy it on the black market, he and a neighbor, Mr. Dornbush, fabricated a moonshine still in the shed behind the house to cook up their own homemade brew. After selling their leftovers to thirsty neighbors and pocketing a little extra money, they had decided to build a second still. Tonight they were going to fire up both stills, and everything had to be ready. Billy sat in his straw-tick mattress for a long time, feeling the corn on his foot throb with each beat of his heart. Eventually, he roused the strength to change. With great relief, he yanked off his shoes. Slipping out of his school pants, he wiggled into his old bib overalls. The cloth shoulder straps were missing, and now the overalls were held up by twine with nails for buttons. The nails slipped easily through the buttonholes in the bib, and when turned sideways, did not come out. Next, he stumped his toe, which meant he took a corn cob and tied it under his painful toe to keep it out of the dirt. Slowly he climbed down the ladder and plodded down the hill to the well by the barn. 2 molasses buckets were sitting next to the pump shaft. Billy pumped them full. Each bucket held half a gallon of water, and it was all his 7-year-old muscles could do to lift them by their makeshift twine handles. That afternoon was warm and perfectly calm. Not a breath of air stirred the dry yellow grass. As Billy started up the path, he heard laughter coming from the ice pond not far away. His buddies were already there, fishing, joking, having a good time. Billy's disappointment broke loose in a flood of tears. Halfway up the hill, next to the garden, Billy sat down to rest under the shade of a large silver poplar tree. Muddy streaks marked his cheeks where the tears had dribbled. He moaned, "Isn't it horrible? All those boys out there fishing, and I have to stay home and pack water." He heard a sound like leaves rustling in the wind. Whoosh! But Billy couldn't feel a breeze. He thought, "What's that?" And he looked around. The leaves, which had just started to turn brown, stood perfectly still. Nowhere could he see even a hint of wind. He continued his sulking. "Their papas don't do this. Why should I have to pack water to these moonshine stills?" He could hear the leaves blowing again. Standing up, he looked up into the branches above him, but he couldn't see anything moving. He squalled out a few more complaints, then picked up his buckets and started up the lane, his stump toe leaving a peculiar track behind him on the dirt path. He had walked only a short way when he heard that noise again, whoosh, louder than before. Billy turned, and this time he saw it. A whirlwind stirred in the branches halfway up the tree. That in itself was not peculiar. Whirlwinds were common in the fall. He had often seen them spinning through fields, picking up dried leaves and carrying them along. But those whirlwinds were always traveling somewhere, always moving across the ground. This whirlwind seemed to be caught in one place. Fascinated, Billy watched the green, brown, and yellow leaves rustle and swirl. Suddenly, a voice boomed from the tree, a deep, resonant voice saying, "Don't ever drink or smoke or defile your body in any way. There will be a work for you to do when you get older." Billy heard the words as clearly as if his father was talking, but it was not his father's voice. He had never heard such an awesome voice before. Dropping his buckets, he took off running for the cabin, screaming with all his lungs. Ella scooped him up in her arms. "Billy, what is it? Did you get snake bit?" She thought that perhaps walking past the garden, her son had stepped on a copperhead, a poisonous snake common in that country. "No, ma'am," he babbled, pointing down the hill towards the garden. "There's a man in that tree down there." "Oh, Billy, Billy, come on. Did you stop and go to sleep?" "No, ma'am, there's a man in that tree, and he told me not to drink or smoke." Ella laughed at this. She hugged her son and kissed his forehead, trying to soothe his nerves, but Billy stayed hysterical and would not calm down. She put him to bed, then hurried to the nearest neighbor who had a telephone and called a doctor. After hearing the story, this doctor said, "The boy's just nervous. He'll get over it." That night, Billy repeated his story at supper. "There's a man in that tree, and I heard what he told me. I ain't never going by there again." And he never did. From that day on, whenever he went to the barn, he would bypass the poplar tree, circling around the far side of the garden. 2 weeks later, Billy and Edward were up in front of the cabin playing marbles under the apple tree when suddenly Billy felt something peculiar come over him, a pressure that set his skin tingling as though some type of unseen energy had surrounded him. He looked up. Somehow the Ohio River seemed closer than it had before. As Billy gazed down the river towards Jeffersonville, the wilderness changed in front of his eyes. A bridge formed up off the bank, spanning the river, piece by piece, being built in fast motion. It was not like the low, flat bridges he had crossed when he had moved to Indiana. This bridge looked huge, with a vast iron trussed arch overhead. Billy had never seen anything like it before. Looking closer, he noticed men working high up on the superstructure. Then he saw a span break. Men tumbled off the beam in slow motion. Billy counted them as they fell. He watched 16 men disappear into the murky water below. Dropping his bag of marbles, Billy took off for the house, screaming uncontrollably. Ella did her best to calm him down. When he finally could tell his story, she said, "Billy, you just dreamed it." Billy insisted, "No, Mama. I got this funny feeling, and then I looked up at the river, and I looked right at it. I seen it. Oh, Mama, I'm scared." Charles gave his opinion. The boy's just nervous, like the doctor said. But Ella was not so sure. She remembered a day 4 years earlier when Billy had babbled something about a bird telling him they would live near New Albany. Oddly enough, that had come true. A bridge across the river? 16 men dying? What if someday it happened? Ella wrote the incident down, thinking, "We'll see."
Chapter 3, The Stink of Poverty, covering the years 1916 to 1917. School expanded Billy's perception in many ways. He learned of a world beyond the green hills of Indiana and Kentucky, a world at war. He heard names of countries he had never known existed, Germany, Austria, Hungary, and he learned how these countries had formed an alliance against France, Great Britain, and Russia. Although in the fall of 1916 the United States of America still remained neutral, Mrs. Temple kept her students informed on foreign affairs. She would often bring a newspaper to school to read the children articles about the war. Billy's imagination stirred with accounts of foot soldiers and commanding generals, fierce battles and romantic heroes. Sometimes he would spend half his lunch hour studying pictures of soldiers that were printed in the newspaper. Occasionally he would even see soldiers in downtown Jeffersonville. Their neat military uniforms fired Billy's 7-year-old imagination, making him long to be a soldier too. Lloyd Ford, a school chum of Billy's, had earned a scout uniform by selling the Pathfinder magazine during the summer months. Lloyd often wore it to school, much to Billy's envy. With its insignia patch on the front, its ranking stripes on the sleeve, its military-style hat, and its single stripe down the outside of each pant leg, Lloyd Ford's scout uniform looked like everything Billy wanted in a suit of clothes. If he could ever wear such a uniform, he knew he would feel so important. One day Billy got up enough nerve to ask Lloyd, "When you wear that uniform out, will you give it to me?" Lloyd said, "Sure, Billy, I'll give it to you." Toward the end of October, the weather turned cold. Frost carpeted the fields each morning and rarely melted off before 10 o'clock. Billy, still with no shirt, shivered as he ran along the Utica Pike. If he got to school early enough, he could warm his goosebumps by the cast-iron coal stove before classes began, and he had to take his assigned seat. Mrs. Wathan, the wife of Charles Boss, must have seen him running to school with a bare chest, because early one day she gave him a used coat with an eagle patch on the arm. Loving the luxury of so much warmth, Billy wore that coat every minute he worked or played outside his cabin. In school, he would keep his coat pinned up to the collar so that none of the other children would see he didn't have a shirt on underneath. Sleeping in the loft at night, Billy and his younger brothers could see stars peeking through the clapboard shingles. When it started to snow, Ella covered her boys with a canvas tarp to keep them dry while they slept. In the morning, that tarp was dusted with snow. Ella had breakfast ready before the boys woke up, hot biscuits and sorghum molasses. One morning she went to the sapling ladder and called, "Billy, you and Edward come down for breakfast." Billy answered, "Mama, I can't see. My eyes have got something in them." The chilly breeze circulating through the loft all night had caused his eyelids to stick shut. Ella said, "You got matter in your eyes. Just a minute, I'll fetch the coon grease." Whenever Charles shot a raccoon, he would cut the fat off the meat and Ella would boil it down into lard, storing it in a can. Coon grease was the family cure-all. Ella would give it to her children for a bad cold with turpentine on it and coal oil. They would swallow it for a sore throat. Now Ella massaged warm coon grease into the boys' eyelids until they could open their eyes. Billy and Edward walked to school in the snow, sometimes following a wagon track, sometimes busting through drifts. They arrived at school soaking wet up to their knees. Fortunately, their wet shoes and pants dried out by lunchtime. They always carried their lunch together in a half-gallon molasses bucket. Inside the bucket, their mother packed a little jar full of greens, another full of beans, 2 pieces of cornbread left over from breakfast, and 2 spoons. Billy could smell the oven-baked bread in the other children's lunches. It smelled so good. He knew now that those children ate sandwiches and cookies for lunch, and he was ashamed to let them see his lowly beans and cornbread. So he and Edward walked down by the river, sat on a log, and set the jars between them to eat their lunch in private. Billy scooped a spoonful of beans first, then Edward poked in his spoon. Then Billy again, taking turns, careful that both jars emptied evenly between them. Near Christmas of 1916, Mrs. Temple had her students cut stripes of red, white, and blue paper and paste them into chains to take home and hang around their Christmas trees. Charles had never had a Christmas tree in the cabin before, but when Ella saw her son's decorations, she was determined that this year would be different. Taking an axe into the woods, Ella brought home a bushy little cedar. She draped the two paper chains over the boughs, but the tree still looked too bare. Charles had grown some popcorn in the garden that summer, and Ella thought this an ideal time to use it. She popped it in a covered kettle shaken over an open fire. With needle and thread, she strung the popcorn into a long chain, then wrapped the chain around the cedar several times until she was satisfied it looked like a proper Christmas tree. After decorating the tree, Ella had some popcorn left over, so she put it in a half-gallon molasses bucket and sent it to school with Billy and Edward for a lunchtime treat. The two boys set their lunch bucket in the cloakroom, on a shelf above where the other children hung their coats. Billy still wore his coat all day, even in the classroom. About 10 o'clock in the morning, Billy's mind wandered to that popcorn. How would it taste, he thought. I wonder if I could try a handful before lunch. So he raised his hand and asked Mrs. Temple if he could be excused to use the outhouse. She said yes. As Billy passed through the cloakroom, he took the lid off the bucket, scooped out a big handful of popcorn, and put the lid back in place. He went outside behind the brick chimney and ate that popcorn, piece by scrumptious piece. Carefully, he wiped his hands and face before going back inside so there would be no evidence to give away his cheating. At lunchtime, Billy and Edward went down by the river to eat on their log. They both wanted to munch the popcorn first. When they opened up the bucket, they could see that a third of the popcorn was gone. Edward looked up at Billy with innocent astonishment and said, "Say, something has happened to that popcorn." Billy tried to look as astonished as his brother. "Yeah, it sure has." Edward never suspected the truth. The boys hung up their stockings on Christmas Eve. The next morning, each found an orange and 3 pieces of candy in his sock. Billy thought, "Oh, what a great fellow Santa Claus is to come and bring me that." He ate his orange Christmas Day, but the peelings he dried and carried with him in his coat pocket for weeks, sucking them like candy. Sometime in January of 1917, Billy noticed that Lloyd Ford had not worn his scout uniform to school since the Christmas break. He asked, "Lloyd, what about that scout suit?" Lloyd said, "I'm sorry, Billy, I forgot that you wanted it. I'll ask my mother." The next day, Lloyd brought disappointing news. "Mother took the coat and made a dog palette out of it, Billy. She used the trousers to patch Dad's pants. I haven't got a thing left but one legging." Undaunted, Billy said, "Then bring me that legging." Now Billy was the proud owner of one legging from a worn-out scout uniform with a stripe down one side and a drawstring on one end. He wanted so much to wear that legging to school, but he could not think of a way to do it. So he slipped the legging into his coat pocket where it would be ready when a good excuse came along. He did not have long to wait. A huge winter storm dumped its white fury all over the Indiana countryside. Some drifts measured 17 feet deep. Next, it sleeted, leaving a glaze of ice on top of trees and snow, making perfect sledding conditions. The students at Utica Pike School now spent their lunch recesses sledding down a large hill close by. All the children had store-bought sleds. All, that is, except Billy and Edward. Billy remembered an old metal dishpan in a dump down by the river. He fetched it, and soon he and Edward joined the rest of the children at the top of the hill. They climbed in the dishpan, Billy in back, wrapping his legs around Edward in the front, and down the hill they scooted, spinning around as they slid. It was great fun, but eventually the rusty bottom wore out of the pan and they had to find something else to use as a sled. This time they transformed a log, chopping on it until the front vaguely resembled a sled runner. The snow conditions were just icy enough so that it worked. The two boys rode their makeshift sled to great speeds on the steepest slope of the hill. On one particular sled run, the boys took a nasty spill at the bottom of the hill. Billy got up with snow crammed down his coat and a dull ache in his leg. Other children gathered around asking if he was all right. "Oh, I hurt my leg," he groaned. Then suddenly he got an idea. "That reminds me. I've got one of the leggings from my scout uniform in my pocket. That will make a good bandage." Taking the legging from his pocket, he pulled it over his tennis shoe and up around his aching leg, securing it in place with the drawstring. Just then the school bell rang, calling them back to class. That afternoon, Mrs. Temple asked Billy to come to the blackboard. He stood sideways working his problem, hoping the other students couldn't tell he had a uniform on just one leg. But of course everyone noticed. Suppressed giggles soon turned into uproarious laughter. Billy started crying, and Mrs. Temple made him go home early. In April, Mrs. Temple brought a Louisville newspaper to school with a headline that screamed, "United States declares war on Germany." She read the article out loud, explaining how on March 18, 1917, German submarines sank three U.S. merchant ships, forcing President Woodrow Wilson to end America's neutrality. The United States of America had entered the war. Outside the schoolhouse, oak trees were budding. The days grew increasingly warmer. In the afternoon, Billy sat sweltering in his heavy winter coat, his toes now stuck up through the holes in the ends of his tennis shoes. One day, Mrs. Temple noticed the students sitting in the back of the classroom making funny faces and holding their noses as if something stunk. She wondered if it had something to do with young William Branham. Why did that boy insist on wearing his coat on such a hot afternoon? She said, "William, why don't you take that coat off? Aren't you warm?" Billy's heart seemed to stop. He couldn't take off his coat. He didn't have on any shirt. "No, ma'am. I'm just a little bit chilly." She was surprised. "You're chilly on a day like this?" "Yes, ma'am." She said, "You better come over here and sit by the fire." Billy had kept his secret all winter long, and he wasn't about to let it out now. Reluctantly, he moved his seat next to the pot-bellied stove while Mrs. Temple threw in another shovelful of coal. Perspiration beaded his forehead, then trickled down his face. Mrs. Temple asked, "William, are you still chilly?" "Yes, ma'am." She shook her head. "You must be sick. You'd better go home." Billy stayed home for several days, wondering how he could get a shirt so he could go back to school. His aunt, his father's sister, lived across the hill from their cabin. She had a daughter about Billy's age. They had recently been over to visit, and his young cousin had left behind a dress. Even though it had decorative rickrack across the front and back, Billy decided he could get a shirt out of that dress. He cut most of the skirt part off and stuffed the rest down his trousers. Then he checked himself in the broken mirror nailed to the apple tree out back. He shook his head and crossed his fingers. When the school children saw the rickrack across his chest, they teased, "That's a girl's dress." "No, it's not," Billy insisted. "This is my Indian suit." They laughed even harder at such a notion and teased him mercilessly. "Billy Branham is wearing a girl's dress. What a sissy." In spite of their ridicule, Billy wore that shirt every day until school let out for summer. He had to. It was the only shirt he owned.